On this program are those of the host and the participants.
All right, greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. Here at WILL AM 580, the NPR affiliate for East Central Illinois. Today we've got a terrific show for you about politics and media, a subject near and dear to my heart and to the heart of many of our listeners. Before we get to the show, though, I do have an announcement of sorts, and or a thank you, I guess would be a better way to put it. Last week, as many of you know, was our pledge drive week here at WILL. AM and FM, the news talk side at the AM and the classical music side on the FM. And we had, as I think many of you know, last week, a special two-hour marathon Media Matters show with our guest John Nichols, likewise with call-in guests Eric Alterman, Laura Flanders, and Amy Goodman. And we were all about trying to raise as much money as possible for WILL AM last week, and I'm delighted to report that Media Matters set the all-time WILL record. Not only did we set the record, much like Barry Bonds demolished the home run mark 3 years ago, we hit it about 700 feet over the center field wall. So thank you very much, all of you listeners who contributed. I think we had approximately 120 people who called in and pledged, and we raised considerably more than $10,000. And since the target for the entire week for both stations was $140,000, what our 2 hours did out of the 336 or so is more than a little impressive. And I think what it does, and I think the message we were saying a week ago on Media Matters, John and I, when we were speaking with you, is it sends a message not just to WILL, not just to NPR locally, but really to NPR affiliates around the country and NPR stations, that there's a crying need and hunger in this country for a discussion of politics which goes beyond the conventional wisdom and the parameters that are put in place through the commercial system, and that it's responded to well by people in communities across this nation, and certainly most definitely what we showed last week here in Champaign-Urbana. So again, thank you all very much. If you got books as a result of your pledges, they are going to be in the mail, we hope, by next week. Some of you will get them before the election. And stay tuned. We've got some great shows in store for you. I think you'll be delighted with what we've got planned, not the least of which is today's show. Our guest today on Media Matters is Lance Bennett, professor of political science and communication at the University of Washington, where he also directs the Center for Communication and Civic Engagement online at www.engagedcitizen.org. And if you get our mailing list, you'll get that link to that sent to you every week. And if you want to get on the mailing list for Media Matters, please be sure to email our producer, Victor Picard, at vpicard, V-P-I-C-K-A-R-D, at UIUC.org. Lance Bennett's work is generally concerned with how various forms of communication affect citizen identification, engagement in politics. He's the author of innumerable, truly innumerable publications, three digits, no doubt in my mind, if we did the tally, including the books Taken by Storm, The Media, Public Opinion, and U.S. Foreign Policy in the Gulf War, Mediated Politics, Communication and the Future of Democracy, and most important, in my view, one of the really seminal works in news media analysis, a book I've relied on heavily as I've developed my own work here and have used in classes, News, The Politics of Illusion, which has six editions now, Lance?
It's in the sixth.
When was the first one?
1983.
My God.
I know. I was in the dark ages of media.
God, yeah, really. The world looked very different in 1983.
It did. It was a simpler world.
Yeah, it was a much simpler world. And so Lance is joining us today. We will take your calls if you like. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, or the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. I should mention that this is a rare situation in which our guest for a live show is actually in the studio here. Lance is not calling from his home in beautiful Seattle, Washington, but rather here in the studio. And you're in town for a conference, Lance, is that right?
Yeah, there's a new institute at the university, the Institute for the Center for the Study of Democracy, and the launch conference is looking at the future of democracy, both in the U.S. and in the world. And I'm happy to be here to give a little part of that.
And that's going to be at the Illini Union this afternoon and then all day Monday and Tuesday, is that right?
Right. It's starting pretty soon now, in 20 minutes, at the Illini Union, room 210.
But people can go after the show if they want.
Yeah, like they can go after.
See, Lance is going to show up
late. Yeah, don't leave.
Fashionably late.
And tomorrow it's running all day from 9 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon in room 314, I believe.
Yeah, 314. Producer Victor Picard just emailed me. And today it's in room 210, both in the Illini Union.
Right.
And people are welcome to come, and there's no charge.
As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, just tell them Lance sent you. Just, yeah. Yeah. Well, let's, you know, this is 9 days before the presidential election, Lance. And we had brunch before the show together, and we're old friends. Lance was on my dissertation committee back in Washington in the 1980s. And so the topic instantly turned to the presidential race and the political races of the year. And I know our listeners are very tuned in there. One of the things that's been striking to me this year, and maybe you can help me understand it better, is that it seems there's a much wider variation in the poll numbers coming out of different states for Bush and Kerry than I recall 4 years ago or 8 years ago or 12 years ago, when it seemed like there was almost always a consensus, except for some pollster that was known for being rabidly one party or the other. But there was always usually within a point or two pretty much a consensus on where states were going and what the polls were. And they were usually fairly accurate for the most part. This year I'm looking at states like Wisconsin, where I'm seeing one day a pollster has got Kerry up by 3 points, and 3 days later a pollster has Bush up by 6 points. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing situations like that in a number of states. Can you help me understand what's going on?
Well, there's several things going on. I think the polls have added more noise than clarity to this election. Mm-hmm. And part of it is that polls are strategically designed. Gallup, for example, oversamples Republicans on the theory that Republicans turn out more and therefore should be represented more heavily in their polls. Whether this should be the case is an interesting question. You also get polls that are talking about national samples when really there are only 11 states that matter in this election. So the national poll and the average of those 11 states are two quite different ways of thinking about public opinion. And the other problem with the polls is that the polls are based on fairly small samples, 700, 800, 900, which really have a pretty big margin of error. And polls are notoriously unreliable in terms of tapping particular kinds of demographic groups, young people, for example. So you would expect to see some swings in these polls, and that's exactly what we're seeing.
So young people are going to be either misrepresented or underrepresented?
They're really underrepresented for a variety of reasons. They tend not to be home very much, waiting for pollsters to call them. And when they are home, they are often annoyed by this and don't participate. So polls really overrepresent senior citizens, for example, housewives who don't have office jobs, but people who are listening for the phone to ring.
Now, is there any research on the percentage of people who are asked to answer these polls and refuse to do so?
Pollsters don't like to give out those figures. I mean, the mystique of the poll in America has become large, and pollsters carefully guard that mystique. So the common wisdom is that we're looking at 40% attrition, which means that if there's any pattern among the 40% or so who say, get out of here.
Yeah.
Which there might be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in that 40%, I confess. And the political scientists out there depend upon polling for their research. I apologize to you, but I'm not generally one who's interested in answering a lot of questions over the phone.
So there is no such thing as a random sample. And obviously, a lot of people in America don't have phones. I mean, there are far more people who have TVs in their homes than phones for various reasons in this country. So they're completely missed.
And cell phones, are they factored into this at all?
There's an interesting controversy that's swirling around on the internet right now about whether cell phone numbers are accessible via the automatic dialing systems that the polling companies use. And some people say no, but the unanswered question, I don't have the answer yet, is whether people whose numbers have migrated from home phone numbers to their cell phones under the new deregulation of that are accessible.
I mean, my hunch would be that cell phone usage would be greater the younger the person.
But
This is just, I have no empirical data.
Very much. Yeah, young people are disproportionately likely to have a cell phone as their only phone.
Yeah. We're talking today with Lance Bennett on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live, so the phone lines are open. Lance Bennett is a professor of political science and communication at the University of Washington, where he also directs the Center for Communication and Civic Engagement. You can find out all about that at www.engagedcitizen.org. Lance Bennett's the author of innumerable publications, as we put it here, including, I think most famously, his book, which has six editions now, News, The Politics of Illusion, first out in 1983, and I think is a commanding book for understanding how the practices and conventions of journalism and how they shape and influence the world we see politically in ways that might not be apparent on the surface. But when you think about it, but very influential book for generations of students now and scholars like myself. If you'd like to call in and have a question for Lance Bennett, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. As you look at the press coverage of the presidential race this year, what are the striking features of it from your years of studying media? I mean, what are the limitations of it? What are the strengths? I mean, what do you see going on?
Well, it's been stunning in so many ways that it's hard to pick even my top 10 list. But I'll give you a couple that strike me as very important. I was watching Hardball with Chris Matthews a couple of weeks ago, and his guest was Bob Schieffer. And this was the program just on the eve of Schieffer moderating the presidential debate. And Matthews was fairly strongly convinced that Dick Cheney had beaten up John Edwards rather badly, and I think he used the prize-fighting metaphor to describe the results of that vice presidential debate. But he did say one thing. He said, but I'm a little bit concerned that the vice president still seems to be misrepresenting the war in Iraq and the connection to al-Qaeda, the weapons of mass destruction issue, using the image of nuclear terrorism strikes in the U.S., And he turned to Schieffer and he said, what do you do, Bob, as a journalist when someone seems not to be telling the truth? Schieffer was basically stunned by the question, as though it had never occurred to him. That wasn't part of his job description. And then they cut to a commercial and all was kind of lost in the ether. But as I see this, there are serious issues of misrepresentation of situations that have been fairly well enough established. And even the leading papers in the realm, the New York Times and the Washington Post, have admitted in kind of large verbiage, prominently displayed in their own papers, that they misreported the war in such fundamental ways that they had to issue public apologies for misreporting the war, because they'd been taken in by the same spin that the administration to this day, on the eve of the election, is still putting out. But what's interesting is that the war coverage itself hasn't substantially changed as a result of the paper's reflection on the early days and the current scene.
Really? Because, what led us to war, if I get this right, was the claim that there was an imminent threat of attacks due to weapons of mass destruction Saddam Hussein held, and that there was a link somehow between Saddam Hussein and Iraq and al-Qaeda and the 9/11 attacks. Now, they've acknowledged, and officially now, it's understood everywhere except in Bush campaign speeches and Cheney campaign speeches, those were not true at all. But today now, the claim is that now we're there to liberate Iraq. This is the new reason to implant democracy. Do you think that the press coverage, how would a press coverage that learned from the past handle this claim?
Well, the war itself might become a different story. Every day we hear about the latest car bombing or rocket-propelled grenade strike on a under-equipped convoy. But what we don't get is any kind of perspective coverage of how's the war going? Is it how many cities have been lost? I mean, those could be headlines. Mm-hmm. 8 cities lost. That's a different thing than another grenade strike in Baghdad in the Green Zone. So I think that those issues are important. But I also think that the issue of the impossibility of the press to respond to the continued misrepresentation to this date at the center of this campaign, the most important issue that the Bush-Cheney side has going for them is fear.
Yeah, the war on terror.
The war on terror.
So the wolves are circling us.
The wolves are circling us, and who knows how effective that ad is. But the message is very clear, is that if you're afraid of terrorism, stick with us, and we'll misrepresent it enough to make you even more afraid. So be afraid. Be very, very afraid. And on the other hand, the press seems unable to handle that other than to report Kerry's responses to it as though it were John Kerry's job single-handedly to dispel the lies that have been circulated through the press to the American people.
Yeah, and that really reminds me. I was at an event in Vermont about 2 years ago, with Representative Bernie Sanders, who's been a guest on this show. And it was a discussion of media coverage, and this was in the spring of 2002. And someone in the audience stood up, and on this very point, he said, "I'm so frustrated with the media in this country because it's sort of." And he was talking about the coverage of the 2000 presidential race in Florida after the election day, and how the press covered it. He said, "What we had is a situation, in effect, where one side would come in and say it's raining outside, And then the other side would say, no, it's not raining outside. And the journalist would report that. Yeah, it's raining outside. One side says, the other side says, no, it's not raining outside. And the guy said, and this is very astute, he said, why doesn't the journalist just walk outside and tell us whether it's raining?
Because, you know. Because they can't.
Yeah. And I think this is what you're getting at.
Exactly.
This,
it's
a liar's paradise.
Well, yeah. Journalism is based on the assumption that we will have a free exchange of documentable ideas, and that journalists' job is to just pass those debated ideas to the public for their own consideration. We report,
you decide. Yeah.
And indeed, we live in a spin zone now where you can't assume anything about the credibility of ideas, and so that people who've used their public access to misrepresent things rather disastrously, driven by ideologies which are, of course, true in and of themselves. And so I think that what we've come to is a national debate which is so polarized because people are finally saying, look, the facts don't matter. What matters is the truth as I understand it, as received from, in some cases, God, and in other cases, from strong value positions in society.
We're talking to Lance Bennett today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Lance Bennett is a professor of political science and communication at the University of Washington, where he directs the Center for Communication and Civic Engagement. Lance Bennett is the author of numerous books, including News, The Politics of Illusion, and is in town today for a conference called Democracy in the 21st Century. It's beginning today at the University of Illinois, and it's this afternoon in room 210 at the Illini Union, all day Monday, 9 to 5. In room 314 in the Illini Union. If you want to call in with a question for Lance Bennett, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free line is open also at 1-800-222-9455. You know, one of the things in your work, Lance, that it was always striking to me, and it's been very influential as I've thought about my analysis of journalism, was you talked a lot about the emphasis on personality over substance in press coverage. And this is back from the very first edition of News, The Politics of Illusion. And it's always struck me how, you know, personality obsessed our coverage is. Mm-hmm. And has that changed since the first edition?
It's changed only in the sense of being more obsessed with the personal in politics.
Well, give some examples of that.
Well, I think that a classic is Bush's aircraft carrier landing in full flight suit and behind the mission accomplished banner. Now, the journalists who were covering that situation understood how contrived it was. I mean, contrived both in the immediate sense of holding an aircraft carrier full of sailors eager to get home to their families off the horizon in San Diego so it could appear to be still far enough out at sea so that Bush needed to land in a jet to get there quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who was covering that event knew it, but they conveniently kind of reduced the horizon of the reporting so that those disruptive facts wouldn't be covered. But also removed in the sense of most of those journalists had also been on the trail of Bush's National Guard service. So the irony or hypocrisy, depending on how you see it, of him arriving in a jet in a flight suit as the commander-in-chief was reportable. But it didn't get reported in the context of the story for the simple reason that it would have damaged the beauty, the perfection of a story that was a complete Hollywood production from beginning to end. So that's the kind of personalization of politics. And what's amazing is the capacity of the Bush communication team, which appears to behave like a team, unlike the Kerry team, which looks like they don't have a playbook. But the Bush communication team to continue to deflect the National Guard story, to continue to deflect the irony of the mission accomplished story, and to spin the entire coverage of the war now into a nice subtext that Bush continues to put out saying, would you rather fight him here or there? And that line is reported by the press as though that is a plausible framing for the war.
Yeah, we can go on, and we're going to. Our guest today, Lance Bennett, here on Media Matters. The phone number, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Lance Bennett.
I love calling. Just wanted to maybe ask if he would talk a little bit about so-called manufactured events, is what I would call it, where it's not really an actual news item, but it's something that gives the appearance of news. For instance, I'm thinking in particular of how radio programs and different forums try to present what they want to show as a balanced reporting by inviting other viewpoints or guests, but they pack it with really fringe people, you know, and give the appearance that the alternatives are just that, fringe. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. I'm thinking in particular of how oftentimes throughout the year, forums have presented people, even Bill Moyers presents, rather than devoting a show to having Ralph Nader explain his views, they will put him, juxtapose him with a libertarian and other type of candidates, and which really weakens his ability to get his views across. Rather than being able to debate with the main party candidates, these people are pressed aside to look as if they're just completely off of the board. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Well, let's let Lance take a crack at that. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, that's a good observation. Seems to me that the formats for these public debate programs are really scripted. I mean, they're as predictable as soap operas. So that if you have a person with one view, you have to balance it out. You can't have a program in which you simply present a view and discuss it and explore it. You have to present it in 30 seconds, and then it needs to be destroyed in 30 seconds.
So for this show to be of that model, I'd have to have someone on here who disagrees
absolutely
with you.
I
interrupt you and be shouting at you and call you a moron.
We have to be screaming, and I shouldn't be allowed to express my opinions as fully as I've been invited to. Well, because why would we want a one-sided view of anything?
Yeah, I mean, these, we talked before the show about Jon Stewart being on Crossfire last week.
That's a good example.
I think many of our listeners might be familiar with that. Jon Stewart was a guest on it, I guess, a week ago. And was quite critical of Crossfire on precisely those grounds. That instead of raising debate, just being partisan hacks, was his term.
Yeah, he said, you guys do the same thing every day. You're paid well. Tucker Carlson comes on as a 30-something with a bow tie to strike a conservative curmudgeon pose, which he may have to have a wardrobe assistant to create every day. So those are moments, and I think what's instructive about the Jon Stewart example is that it became so instantly distributed across the net. I mean, someone had obviously had their TiVo on and simply streamed it back out, and those files are now available in many places on the web.
New York Times wrote a big feature story on that just a couple of days thereafter. We're talking to Lance Bennett today on Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Lance Bennett.
Yes. I have a question for both of you. Do you think that the people like yourselves who are scholars of the media, as you're discussing on this program, have your own sets of biases, just as you find biases in journalism and problems with the journalism, but the scholars of journalism and scholars of the media, do you have biases? And secondly, and which I know you do, of course. I mean, everybody does. But then the question is, do you have a responsibility to acknowledge your biases, to say, this is where I'm coming from? That is, I'm making these comments about the political process, but I'm doing it from my own particular perspective. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah. Lance, I'm sure this is a question you've wrestled with.
Yeah, it's a fundamental question. And, of course, we have biases. Everybody does, as the caller pointed out. And my way of beginning to address those and to explore them, because it seems to me that we need to figure out what they are in order to deal with them in some way, is to hold myself accountable to a standard of democracy that I think is defensible, that is not radical, that's not revolutionary, that simply involves having a diversity of voices in public life allowed to explore positions that are not heard as often as we might like, so that most voices are not marginalized, and that there is some way of translating those public conversations, which can be deadly boring in many of the forms we've heard them, I'm sure, translating them into mechanisms of accountability so that the press reports them as part of a story and also so that politicians might want to respond to them as part of their public duty.
can scholars or journalists or any citizens who have values or biases, pick your term, can they be, does that ultimately make us all propagandists? Does that ultimately corrupt our ability to really be honest or trustworthy?
Well, I think that the big dilemma we face in public life today is the swirl of ideas without any real sort of public etiquette for how to resolve them, how to respect them, how to distill them, how to take on an obligation to respond to other points of view, and to figure out how to get those voices represented both in the press and in our government. So we need to have conversations like that kind of float a little bit above the noise of debate. Because if you add it up, there's lots of voices out there every day. The question is, what's the individual citizen to do? And many people are confused. I mean, in defense of bias, I'll say this, that most of us from elementary school on are indoctrinated is not too strong a word. Indoctrinated into the requirement to look for both sides of a story. And indeed, we see it in every TV program. We sometimes see it in every news article, unless it's thoroughly dominated, as the war was, by one side. And the other side simply took a pass, namely the Democrats early on in this process. But we look for both sides in everything, and then the standard citizen response, if the citizen is without a prior point of view, is to remain confused and ultimately disheartened. So it seems to me that the defense of bias, and we can go back to historical eras in which there were strong partisan press, there are still countries in this world that advocate partisan press and forums in which all candidates can have public access to the time required to present their positions and be required to present those positions in something other than a 30-second scary ad spot. So that we do have capacity as human beings to understand a point of view and to reconcile it if we are in the middle of a communication system that helps us rather than hinders with that.
Isn't that what scholars at their best are doing? Isn't that what academic life at its best? I mean, no political scientist claims I'm going to be neutral and I'm not making an argument.
Well, many do, actually.
Well, they shouldn't.
The majority do, and those are the majority.
But they do have arguments, though. I mean, they have arguments, even if they claim they don't have any biases. They end up with some sort of position they're laying forth at the end of the day. I mean, the great scholarship is driven by people making arguments that are quite clear about where they're coming from, but then debating evidence and challenging and I mean, if it's good, it can handle contrary
That's
positions
right.
and stand up to criticism. It doesn't say, because of my bias, I ignore criticism of where I'm coming from. It says, bring it on, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's right. And fields vary. You know, economics has a very strong paradigm in which dissident views are simply not heard. Communication is a field that's much more open to a diversity of perspectives and has, for that reason, become an interesting place for me to be as a scholar. Political science is a little bit more like economics in the sense of publishing in the mainstream journals, primarily voices that are quite centrist, often driven by economic theories which take a implicitly conservative view of human behavior and a kind of a discouraging view of citizen grassroots political activism.
We're talking to Lance Bennett today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Lance Bennett's a professor of communication and political science at the University of Washington, the author of numerous books, including News, the Politics of Illusion. He is in town for the inaugural conference for democracy in the 21st century beginning today, this afternoon, in fact, shortly, at Illini Union in room 210 and all day tomorrow in room 314 in the Illini Union. Speaking of diverse views or views you don't always hear elsewhere, the next few guests on Media Matters will be Janine Jackson, the program director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Paul Krugman, a New York Times columnist, will be on the air in a few weeks. And then here, Lance, I know how you're a rock and roll buff. I've got a trivia question for you. What noted intellectual figure has had a pop song written about him or for him by Mick Jagger and by John Lennon?
I know you know the answer to this question.
I gave it to you before the show. This,
I was, like, this I was like, in the middle of brunch.
This is like Hollywood Square, so they
Sorry,
feed
I
you
didn't
the questions
write it down.
Ahead of time. Okay. Tariq Ali will be here, and he actually, the song Street Fighting Man by the Rolling Stones was written by Mick Jagger for him back in 1968, and Power to the People by John Lennon. And we taped a show with Tariq yesterday. It will air in a few weeks because he was in town visiting. Let's go back to our phone lines. Again, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455, and the toll-free line is open. If you do call, we will make a point of getting to you, so please do call up. We've got another 20 minutes or so, and let's go back to the lines, as I said. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Lance Bennett.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people talk about fair and balanced news, and I heard you recently talking about bias and being not biased, and what I expect of the media is an unbiased opinion, and what I am presented is a balanced view of truth and lies. And, you know, a balanced view of slamming President Bush and then slamming John Kerry. And it's not presenting an unbiased opinion. It's presenting a balanced opinion or a biased opinion that I see. Is there any move to change it back to an unbiased opinion, or are we stuck with fair and balanced?
Well, those are interesting attempts, I think, on the caller's part to go back to the roots of these concepts. And mm-hmm. And I think the American press is rootless these days, and I mean that very literally. The American press system is the freest in the world by many measures. I mean, the least supervised, the least monitored, the least regulated. I know, Bob, you've been on a mission in recent years to restore some of the public service regulations to the American media system. But so the fact is that the press has, in a way, begun to hide behind the First Amendment. I don't mean the press as just individual journalists. I mean, the First Amendment provides important protections for individual journalists. But I think that they provide a distressing hiding place for large media corporations who've taken their First Amendment liberties to extremes, supported by the Supreme Court and the FCC, of course, and actually used their public airtime to tell discouraging news stories, to wait to see who's got the biggest reaction to the event of the day and make that the headline rather than trying to figure out what a reasonable reaction from an independent press perspective might be to those stories, which is really the whole reason why the New York Times and the Washington Post finally reassessed, at the pressure of their own ombudsman and public criticism, their coverage of the Iraq War and essentially said, we're sorry, we were spun too severely. We did report some of the facts to the contrary, but they were reported in the back pages. And Ahmad Chalabi, as an often unnamed source, actually drove the headlines on the front pages.
You know, one of the things the caller got at, too, which we've talked about a lot, we talked about it before the show, which is a tendency in political journalism historically, but especially we see it, it's pronounced, I think, now, that if, for example, if one of the candidates for president has done something really bad, to mention it, to be not be considered biased against that candidate, you have to look to the other candidate and dredge up something and say, well, you know, George Bush lied about going to the war in Iraq, but, you know, John Kerry, you know, took his towel from the hotel this morning.
Exactly.
So both of them are really exactly. bad guys here.
Yeah, that's become the obligatory balance in every news story. And I think that this is – studies are clear that a lot of people have simply disconnected from news. So one of the things that I think that we're most in danger of is because of this spiral of negativity, because of the incessant balancing of stories to the point of confusion, because of letting who has the best spin patrol – drive the headlines and putting the facts to the contrary in the back pages. Because of all of these realities of the American press, these are not just isolated instances. This is the daily news that we're talking about. Citizens are disconnecting. And the TV news audience is not just graying. I mean, so citizens are disconnecting in a couple of ways. There's the graying of the news audience because mm-hmm. there are those who were born into an earlier generation of sort of dutiful citizenship who still feel that for all the unpleasantness of it, they need to remain informed and try to sort through all of this information. But there's also an absolute loss of news audience, so that even older generations are disconnecting out of distress with the information problems that we've been discussing.
We're talking to Lance Bennett today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're talking about a journalism which is not doing a very effective job of drawing people into public life and making them informed participants, governors of their own lives. You know, there's been a couple of things we talked about off air that sort of are striking. One is the Carter Center under Jimmy Carter, which goes around the world monitoring elections. And they've done over 50 elections in 20-plus countries around the world in every continent, except Antarctica, I guess, but all the other continents.
Penguins don't vote.
Yeah, I guess Australia, I don't know if they've done that, but let's say Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Europe. Jimmy Carter was on David Letterman last week, and Letterman asked him, well, how about the United States? Is the Carter Center going to come here with all the problems we have now with our elections? And Carter said that no, he couldn't, because in effect, the United States doesn't meet the criteria of a democracy in a number of respects. Most importantly, it doesn't give airtime to candidates for free so that the public has access to know who they are, which is they have to do that in Uzbekistan before the Carter Center will even go into there.
Yeah, I've heard – I didn't hear the Letterman interview, but perhaps some of your listeners also heard the one that I did listen to, which was his interview with Terry Gross. I think it was Thursday afternoon. And she asked the same question because it's the obvious question. We've had such a scandal in our elections that most people want Jimmy Carter to come and monitor Florida and perhaps also monitor Ohio and a couple
of
other states.
There are a lot of states who could be monitoring based on what we're hearing.
Exactly. And Carter's response was, as you said, but what stunned me actually was that the Carter Center has developed a list of five or so points, I can't remember the exact number, that a nation has to qualify on in order for the Carter team to come in.
It's got to be sufficiently democratic.
Yeah. And the U.S. misses almost all of them. Not just the idea that the government or the public service broadcasters have to provide open opportunities for candidates to appear freely and discuss their positions rather than buy time to spend 30 seconds scaring people with their positions. But in addition, I thought it was a very interesting observation he made. He said the United States is moving farther away from these democratic criteria. And the one that he mentioned that seemed most compelling for this election is that there must be some record of the vote that enables a recount. Mm-hmm. And he's saying that with the rise of paperless voting machines, there is no capacity to recount even if some of these states, which may well happen this time, end up going into court because one party or the other challenged the propriety of the electoral process. How do you recount a voting machine that doesn't produce a receipt?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Another area along that line is the voter turnout rate in this country compared to other countries. I mean, it's talked about periodically, but it's not given a lot of attention that we have one of the lowest turnout rates for voters in the world. And presidential races get by far the highest. And I think this year they're anticipating perhaps 50 or 51%, 52%. But it's really extraordinarily low compared to similar countries around the world with similar political economies.
Yeah, it's a very interesting phenomenon. The turnouts have been dropping. They seem to have bottomed out at around 50% in the presidential years and less than that in the off-year congressional elections. I think this election will be a bit surprising. I think that young people are going to vote in larger numbers this year than at any time, at least since 92, when Ross Perot somehow appealed to enough young people to produce a stronger than average turnout. So we'll see what happens here. What I hope, though, is that in this election, when more people turn out, I think we could hit, oh, let's get wild here, 53, 54%.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. It's stunning. That what I hope is that these first-time voters or infrequent voters don't end up feeling that their vote was lost because of polling issues, because of lawyers fighting over the recounts in these states. That, I think, would be a discouraging result for citizens. I hope that we will wake up the next morning and discover that we have a president.
Yeah, we're talking to Lance Bennett today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got time for some calls, and we've got a full bank of phone lines. So let's go back to the lines right now. Line 3, Urbana, thank you for your patience.
Yeah, I wanted to mention or ask you something about something that you've mentioned about 20 minutes ago when you said that the Bush team, the Bush media team had done a good job of deflecting the story, the mission accomplished story. And then you said the National Guard story, which you mentioned a couple minutes ago. I hope that everyone realizes, or we should realize, that the National Guard story, like the Swift Boat veteran story, is not even really a story. What these guys did 30 or 35 years ago, absent, you know, some mass murder or something, what these guys did that long ago should not be on the radar screen. We should be talking about what people have done in the past 4 years or what people have done in the past 20 years, not what happened when many of the people who are going to be voting were not even born.
Yeah, Lance?
Well, I agree in spirit with those comments, but I think that one of the things that back to the idea of personalizing and emotionalizing
this really definitely applies to our
politics, is that our elections are really not so much about issues. I mean, there's some targeting of issues to really small groups who may make a decision in part based on an issue like the prescription drug issue for senior citizens, various moral issues for Christian groups. But the bigger question for most people is really who do they feel comfortable inviting over to dinner? And, you know, that gets us into these questions about who are these people and what is their history of adultery, drug abuse, war, fighting or not fighting. And those become spun endlessly to the point that it seems the character becomes the primary issue, which in many ways it is, both because it makes for the best news story, but also because people in America are not electing a political party to represent them, as is the case in many European parliamentary systems. But they're electing a president to somehow preside over the national family.
And, you know, this week, the University of Maryland's public opinion research office issued another of its very interesting reports. They've got some interesting people working there, asked different questions than a lot of these other public opinion scholars. And they did a survey of committed Bush supporters and committed Kerry supporters to find out their knowledge levels of the world. And what was striking was that committed Bush supporters still, to this day, a significant percentage, I think a majority, a considerable majority, in fact, still believe that Saddam Hussein is connected to 9/11 and that we actually found stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction there.
The weapons of mass destruction belief is very strong. It was well over 65% of Bush supporters believe that there was some weapons of mass destruction at the beginning of this war. And what that suggests to me is precisely what the caller's question led us to talk about here, is that people are making up their minds in many cases in very fundamental emotional ways, and then they're casting about to look for reasons. Mm-hmm. And in this case, as long as Dick Cheney is still out there saying that there were weapons of mass destruction, I mean, Cheney's speeches out on the campaign trail today are still talking about Saddam had weapons programs or would have started them up or hedging that fine distinction.
And certainly the argument is that this is all about the war on terror. I mean, there's no.
This is all about the war on terror, which is back to the subtle shift. I mean, there's Kerry has tried to accuse Bush of flip-flopping from the original, which is weapons of mass destruction and al-Qaeda connection, to the current. Bring him on. Would you rather fight him there or in the streets of Manhattan or Omaha or Champaign? And the flip-flopping charge is sort of lost because I think that in a way, in the simple logic of emotions connected to rationalizations, a lot of people are thinking about, you know, I'm sorry that the troops are over there and that the casualty counts are higher and we seem to be having trouble maintaining control of most of the cities. But, you know, I do think that we're fighting them over there and not in the streets of Omaha.
We're talking to Lance Bennett today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Champaign, you're on the air with Lance Bennett.
Hi. Well, I was wondering if you'd further elaborate on the Bush administration's argument that we'd rather that it's better to fight the terrorists in Iraq than in the U.S. Because I find this a really troubling argument. It doesn't really seem to be true or have much validity at all. It would mean that our forces would be fighting in Iraq for quite a long time, and they're just shooting ducks. I was hoping that you could elaborate on that a little further.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Well, You know, let me step back from that question just a little bit and talk about what you would read about this situation if you were in almost any other country in the world, Canada, Mexico, Italy, Spain. And what you hear is that, yes, indeed, there seems to be a growing insurgency, but European nations are deeply worried, as I read their news reports, about the number of young men, generally, who are being recruited, who have come to France, for example, as immigrants, or Sweden as immigrants, and who are now being recruited to go off and fight the jihad in Iraq. And so as we fight them there, the ranks of the jihad army are swelling. And the question is, what happens if the war ends? I mean, everyone is worried about this, where are we going to be fighting them question. It's a reasonable question. Question is, what should the policy look like that best minimizes the numbers of people who would like to attack us, let's say, yeah, as opposed to maximizes the growth rate of people who would like to attack us?
Which I assume that plan B is the current model.
It seems that we are choosing one of those models that if you wanted to make the size of the jihadi army as large as you could imagine, this would be the way to do it.
In fact, you know, this isn't just your opinion, obviously. The Israeli intelligence has written about this.
Oh, intelligence. There was an interesting article that I came across the other day that I believe was in BBC's homepage talking about French intelligence reports, which had looked at the path of some of these folks. Who'd gone off to fight in Afghanistan. This was the last iteration of this, and come back to actually promote terrorism on the ground in Europe. And so we may well be fighting a larger number of them at home if this war ever ends. But I agree with the listener's caller that how long would this go on over there is an interesting
question. But isn't it striking that this point, which you just made, which to me makes perfect sense. In fact, I can't think of any empirical data that contradict it, that our policies are promoting our widespread hatred of the United States among far too many people who would then be tempted by joining Al-Qaeda or a similar movement, is really not talked about in our news media. That's like off limits.
That could be a story.
It's a very interesting story, isn't it?
It is.
The complete failure of these policies to do ideally what we want, which is fewer terrorists.
Well, and part of the problem is that it's a story that's unsustainable. And the media need to have mechanisms to sustain the story. And the reason it's unsustainable is it would be immediately shouted down by Bush and Cheney and many of their supporters. Immediately shouted down.
Sean Hannity's head would explode.
Yeah, and that would be a fascinating moment on TV as well. Real TV. Mm-hmm. The problem is that then the press, rather than mediate the story in some independent way and just create available sources to write the story, would then go to Kerry and company for a reaction. And that reaction would sound too complicated. And then it would be, again, roundly slammed as too nuanced, to cite one of the slogans from a
not
few weeks
morally
back.
Morally pure game. Enough to like take on the enemy.
It's not simple. This person is too intellectual about something that we all know what the right thing to do looks like.
We're talking to Lance Bennett today in Media Matters. We've only got a few minutes left, but I'm going to make sure we get to our remaining callers. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Lance Bennett.
Okay, well, I had a couple of things, but I'll focus on the Sinclair thing. I was just wondering how you would comment on it. To me, it looked like they were really running scared that they feel that they could their licenses are challengeable in a lot of the places where they have sprung up and bought, because they only ended up running about 6 minutes of Stolen Honor, and they ran part of Going Upriver, and they actually had a panel, sort of a panel, with a guy who was a Winter Soldier testifier. I don't know how many people actually saw it. In this market, they didn't really advertise much when it was going to be on, and I ran into a number of people who are informed who didn't know it was already run. I don't know, maybe they're running it again, but to me it illustrates why I disagree with a previous caller who said all of this stuff is ancient history. I mean, the same kind of cognitive dissonance, as it was called in the Pieper Report, or denial, that allows a guy who's on the Stolen Honor, POW, traumatized, of course, but allows him to say that something happened with Lieutenant Callie, but I'm not sure what it was or what he sort of just punted that. I think it's, while war crimes are probably going on as we speak, and Abu Ghraib being one of them, it's important to say, you know, the same kind of mechanism is going on. And if we I'd like for you all to comment on that, and particularly the chances that Sinclair is if you see the same motivation, because the last thing they did, and they're actually running a PSA also, which calls for people to support them, that they feel very, very vulnerable at this point, I think.
Lance, did you watch that Sinclair program he's talking about?
I didn't see the program, but I followed the controversy about its intended airing quite mm-hmm. carefully. What I think happened there, and it's very interesting, that first of all, it's a little outrageous that broadcasters who've been given public licenses would go ahead and run a propaganda film. Not that there's a wide deviation from that in a lot of the news that we see, which happens to be spun independently of the broadcaster, yeah. and therefore it looks to be somewhat cleaner in mm-hmm. terms of independence. But what was interesting is and something we haven't touched on that I would very much like to before the hour has escaped us, is that citizens do have other ways to communicate these days, is that the people who are frustrated with the conventional media are increasingly going online for news information, but also for a different kind of information that links to what can I do? This information age isn't sort of the disconnected old citizenship model of information where you get informed and then you contemplate what's the best choice in an election. Citizens today are busy. They have a lot of access to information, but they also want to know what to do with it. So a lot of the news that came out on Sinclair traveled widely over the internet through blogs and various kinds of websites. I'm sure you posted this story on yours. And citizens were given things that they could do, such as bomb the FCC with email, write emails to Congress and so on. But also the discussion about that became very interesting and may have awakened Sinclair itself to its own best interests. In a sense, Sinclair was putting some chips on the table for the Bush election. And a lot of the discussion on the blogs is, are these guys going to be in trouble if Bush loses this election or what? And my guess is that the board of Sinclair might have had a second thought about all of that after the citizen response to it suggested, if Kerry wins, do you guys think that you're going to escape some punishment here?
Yeah, and I think the balance of the commercial media owners were not too happy with what they'd done, too, because it drew attention again to concentrated ownership and some of the problems that are attendant to that. And they'd rather not have that be a subject that's on the front burner of the popular mind.
Just a flip side of that is that I've noticed that Fox has begun to run what I think are free spots for both candidates on issues right now, which for those of you who think Fox is just a right-wing cheerleading squad, they appear to have stepped forward in a public-spirited sort of way.
Well, Lance Bennett, I hear the band tuning up in the background, and that usually means we've got to clear out of the studio and let them set up shop here. Thank you so much for joining us today here.
It's
in
been
Media
a pleasure.
Matters. It's always a
Very
pleasure.
Very nice to be here.
Yeah, it's a gas to have you here. I want to thank also our producer, Victor Picard, who arranged this show, as he does every week. Did a terrific job.
Victor is remarkable.
Victor is an old friend of Lance's, too. It's a small world, listeners, you're running about here. This is my personal friend show you're discovering. I'm Bob McChesney. I'm your host here of Media Matters. I'll be back in 167 hours and can't wait to talk to you then. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Devro TPAC in Danville, Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur, EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont, and Citizen Sandwich and Convenience, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, sunny with a high in the upper 60s and west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low in the mid-40s and west winds around 5 miles per hour in the evening, shifting to the south after midnight. Tomorrow, mostly sunny in the morning, then becoming partly sunny, the high in the upper 60s with south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour in the morning, shifting to the southwest in the afternoon. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at WILL.UIUC.EDU. It's 2 p.m. Central Time.